Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 11th of July, these are our main stories. The head of Britain's diplomatic service says the resignation of Britain's ambassador to the US over a leaked memo that criticized Donald Trump is unprecedented. Researchers have found the earliest example of humans outside Africa, a skull that's over 200,000 years old. The US women's football team celebrate their World Cup win with a victory parade in New York. Also in this podcast, why an Indian state is getting teachers to send their selfies or lose a day's pay. And
we absolutely do feel for the people who are now complaining. They want to have a quiet day, but we do think that there are a lot of possibilities to minimize the noise.
A school in the Netherlands could be facing a hefty fine because the children are too noisy. If you listened to the last edition of the Global News Podcast, you'll have heard that Britain's ambassador to the US, Sir Kim Darroch, has resigned. It all began when diplomatic memos in which Sir Kim criticized President Trump's administration were leaked. Then Mr. Trump hit back in his customary way on Twitter, calling him a very stupid guy and refusing to work with him. The Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt called it a black day for British diplomacy, and the head of the diplomatic service, Sir Simon MacDonald, said the ambassador's treatment was unparalleled.
Nothing like this has ever happened before. No. There must be consequences. The United States is our closest ally. Across the board, in all spheres of life, we have the closest relationship with the United States. And I would add that we have a close relationship with the President of the United States, that the state visit last month, I think, was a personal success. This is at variance with that success. This is, as everybody is agreeing, unprecedented. But we will find a way through because we must.
Tim Franks has been speaking to Gus O'Donnell, who for several years was Britain's highest-ranking civil servant, the cabinet secretary, the most senior official advising three different prime ministers between 2005 and 2011. What did he make of the ambassador's resignation?
Well, I'm very proud of Sir Kim for doing this. I've known Kim for a very long time. He's been a great diplomat, great member of the Foreign Service, great national security advisor. What he's done is put the country first, right? He has said, look, the UK-US special relationship, which is absolutely vital, we both care about this, and we need someone who can do that job. And Kim has said, look, in the circumstances, as a result of this leak and the response, I can't do the job as well as I would like to, therefore I'm standing down. And he's put the importance of the job against his own personal ambitions.
What about this argument? I mean, you say that he's putting the country first. There may be some who feel that actually the way he could protect British interests best would be to say, I'm not going to be bullied or intimidated by what the president has said about me. I was just doing my job.
Look, let's be clear. He was just doing his job and he did exactly the right thing. He did what civil servants and diplomats are required to do, which is speak truth unto power, tell us honestly and objectively what he really thinks. We don't want to hear what people think we want to hear. So he was doing exactly the right thing. The only problem here was the leak, and the leaker is the person to whom we should concentrate all of our firepower to find out who this was and then deal with them extremely severely.
Do you think there is a danger that one of the things that's going to happen out of this is that fewer people will get to see these diplomatic cables because there's, you know, the danger of them getting out into the open and causing embarrassment is there?
I'm not privy to what the circulation lists were for these diptels, as we call them, and how many people got to see them. But yes, I think there is a case, and I'm sure my successor will look at this to say how wide was the circulation for these matters. And our relationship with the United States is a very strong and large relationship. So a number of things that are written by the embassy in Washington. You have to copy to a number of different departments, but quite possibly we'll need to think very carefully about precise telegrams with particular wording that we may need to give even more restricted access to.
The former British Cabinet Secretary Gus O'Donnell speaking to Tim Franks. I asked our diplomatic correspondent James Robbins whether Britain will have been surprised by the ferocity of President Trump's tweets attacking both Sir Kim and Theresa May herself.
I think that officials in London were startled by the really incendiary nature of the president's tweets. I mean, we've been used, haven't we, to strong language in his often early morning tweets from the president. But nevertheless, I think the fact that he went back on the attack against Theresa May, the prime minister personally, I think that made it even more difficult for the ambassador. And he felt that perhaps the time had come when he had to stand aside.
And does this show basically the power the US holds over the UK at the moment, with Brexit looming and London needing this trade deal with Washington so badly?
Well, in part, it maybe does show that. We can talk about that. But I think it also shows that this is a president without precedent. I mean, we just haven't been used to diplomacy, particularly between friendly states, being carried out in this way. You have to go right back to the 19th century, apparently, to find an example of a British ambassador being unpopular in Washington, 1856, actually, because he was apparently trying to recruit Americans to fight with Britain in the Crimean War. So you've got to go back a very long way to find anything like this. On the Brexit question, yes, it's true, London wants to remain as close to Washington as possible, not least because it needs to negotiate a future trade deal if it leaves the European Union.
And will this undermine the ability of the next ambassador to do his or her job?
Not necessarily. Britain will have a new prime minister within a couple of weeks. That process is now well advanced to find a successor to Theresa May. And we know it'll either be Jeremy Hunt, the present foreign secretary, or Boris Johnson. And they, of course, will now be appointing a new ambassador to Washington. It could actually be not a diplomat, but a political appointment. That's happened before. Very unusual in the British system, very common in the American system. Could happen because a whole lot of rebuilding is going to have to take place and a completely new relationship will have to be made.
James Robbins. A human skull, which is 210,000 years old, has been discovered in Greece, making it the earliest evidence of modern humans in Europe. This would mean their arrival happened 150,000 years earlier than previously thought. Our science correspondent, Paul Rincon, told me more.
Well, they found the skull of the oldest modern human, so our species, ever found outside Africa. It's 210,000 years old, and it's older than we thought that humans, you know, made it out of Africa. It's been found in Greece, the cave in Greece, and it was actually found in the 1970s. But it's taken until now with modern techniques, computer tomography and modern dating techniques to really uncover its secrets. I spoke to Professor Chris Stringer from the Natural History Museum.
So it pushes back the time that modern humans are getting out of Africa, and it particularly pushes back the time that we find them in Europe by a long way. And this means modern humans were at least potentially in contact with the Neanderthals in Europe over 200,000 years ago.
So how significant is that fact that modern humans were in contact with Neanderthals that long ago? And how does it change what we already knew about modern humans in Europe?
Yeah, it's really significant because the wave of human migration that we belong to actually happened 60,000 years ago. So there was a big wave out of Africa 60,000 years ago that led to the peopling of the world and the replacement of other groups like the Neanderthals. But we've, over the last few years, come to the understanding that there was an earlier wave. So we've had fossils from the Near East that are about 150,000 years old, fossils from China about the same date. We've now got these fossils that were even earlier from Europe. So it means that they got out earlier and ranged further. But these, weirdly, didn't leave any descendants. So this earlier wave went extinct, and we really don't know why, whether it was something down to the climate or some other factor that led them to die out.
So would that have any impact on the humans of today then, or would they have died out and not made any impact on us?
Well, we're studying DNA from very distant and disparate populations, and people are looking for whether there was a signal of this earlier population that was out in Eurasia much earlier than most of us have our ancestry from. We haven't found it yet, but interestingly, we have found some signs in Neanderthals. So they've actually managed to extract DNA from ancient Neanderthal remains, and they show signs of breeding with modern humans much earlier than our wave of migration left Africa. So that may be a signature of this much earlier wave of people getting out of Africa and into other parts of the world.
Paul Rincon. The recent HBO miniseries Chernobyl has prompted an increase in the number of people wanting to visit the location of the world's worst nuclear accident. Now, Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, himself a former TV star, has signed a decree to transform the area around the Chernobyl nuclear reactor into a tourist site. The announcement came at an official ceremony transferring to Ukraine the ownership of the gigantic metal structure that encloses the reactor. Danny Eberhard reports.
The site of the world's worst peacetime nuclear catastrophe might appear an unlikely sell, but Volodymyr Zelensky is brimming with optimism. Chernobyl, he admitted, had been a negative part of Ukraine's brand, but now he believes the region is due a new lease of life. It was, he said, a unique place to show how nature can revive after a global man-made disaster, adding too that it had a real ghost town. We have to show this to the world, he said. Scientists, ecologists, historians and tourists.
Danny Eberhard. It's been a giant street party in New York City as the U.S. women's football team went on a victory parade following their fourth World Cup win. They beat the Netherlands 2-0 in Sunday's final in France. But it wasn't all about the team's sporting success. There were also serious messages addressing the current state of politics and equal pay for women. This is what the team's co-captain, Megan Rapinoe, had to say.
Thank you so much. It's not possible without everyone. We really do appreciate all that it takes to shut down the biggest, best city in the world. For the biggest, best team in the world. Thank you for that. That means the world to us. I think I'll just end with this. This is my charge to everyone. We have to be better. We have to love more, hate less. We got to listen more and talk less. We got to know that this is everybody's responsibility. Every single person here. Every single person who's not here. Every single person who doesn't want to be here. Every single person who agrees and doesn't agree. It's our responsibility to make this world a better place. I think this team does an incredible job of taking that on our shoulders and understanding the position that we have and the platform that we have within this world. Yes, we play sports. Yes, we play soccer. Yes, we're female athletes, but we're so much more than that. You're so much more than that.
Mary Kate is a fan of the team who was there at the parade.
It's super patriotic, but in a refreshing way. It's so pure. This is America's team. This is new America's team. Rapinoe, who has been the most outspoken about everything, she got the loudest cheers. Everybody just went nuts when her float came down. She was carrying a big bottle of champagne. She's totally a rock star in New York City, and we absolutely love her here.
Well, as the cleanup operation was underway, I spoke to our correspondent in New York, Neda Tofik, about the day's events.
There was so much energy from the crowd. Thousands of fans gathered along Broadway here in Lower Manhattan, an area known as the Canyon of Heroes. And the U.S. women's soccer team had their signature swagger. They were dancing on the floats, sipping champagne and waving to the crowds. And we spoke to many people here who gathered not just to celebrate, but also to stand with these women in their call for equal pay. So many young girls, their mothers, fathers, young boys saying that these women deserve it.
So the World Cup might be over and the celebrations, from the sound of it, it looks like you've got the cleanup operation happening behind you, but the battle for equal pay continues.
Absolutely. And these women have shown their perseverance in this fight, using their platform to speak about it. We heard from city officials who said that compared to 4 years ago when the women's team won, there has been so much more interest because these women have become icons. They've used their platform to really push for gender equality. And you have the likes of New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo saying, let's be honest, if it's about talent, if it's about who deserves it more, the women should be getting paid more than the men because of their success.
And some of the women have found themselves at odds with President Trump. Is that still going on?
That is absolutely still going on. Megan Rapinoe, the U.S. forward and co-captain, as recently as yesterday said that she, if she had to give a message to President Trump, it would be that he is not including women like her who are gay, others from different backgrounds, saying that she believes the rest of the team is with her and not wanting to give President Trump a platform. And it's interesting that the team has reacted much more enthusiastically to invitations from the Democrat Chuck Schumer here from New York, as well as the House Speaker, Democrat Nancy Pelosi, to visit Congress and to call for equal pay, the issue they're most passionate about.
Yes, and is it fair to say that with this win at the World Cup and all the attention this World Cup had and the large audiences on television, that this is a big moment for women's football, that it's really now arrived, as it were, as a major sport in the U.S. and elsewhere?
I think the big test of that is whether after the spotlight is gone, after the excitement of the World Cup has faded, if fans will still turn out to the women's games. And those numbers have been increasing. Viewing figures on television have increased. And so you've seen signs here at the parade where literally young girls holding up signs saying, we will continue to watch, really echoing the calls of the women's team for fans to support their local clubs teams, the Women's National League here in the United States. So certainly this could be seen as many as a major turning point for these women.
Neda Tofik in New York and the very noisy post-parade cleanup operation behind her. Uttar Pradesh is India's largest state with a population of 200 million and plenty of rural and remote areas. The state's education authorities have adopted a novel idea to prevent absenteeism among teachers. Send your selfie before starting class or lose a day's salary. The BBC's Sangeeta Rajan has been following the story.
So a lot of teachers don't turn up to schools in these remote areas. To mark the attendance, they have these proxies, and these are like underqualified people who would go sign in for them. Also, not just that, they teach the children, which is not acceptable by the education authorities, but they have to upload the selfie by 8 a.m. to this website where that manages all these government schools. So they need to upload their selfie by 8 a.m. and if they don't, they lose the day's pay. But it's in hundreds of teachers who have been misusing the system. And there have been plenty of reactions. There are teachers who are saying that it is really, really hard to go reach the remote area every day on time before 8 a.m. and send the selfie when there's very little network or a lot of poor connectivity there. A lot of teachers are saying this is practically not possible because we lose a day's salary despite being there and just because the technology is not working properly or just because someone else is not doing the job properly, we are losing out on it. And teachers have been saying, and I just wanted to point out that this is not the first time this is happening. This similar sort of initiative was taken by in another state, the Uttarakhand. Reason being, again, ghost teachers and teachers not showing up, turning up to schools in remote areas where there's very little inspection and there's very little that students can do if the teacher doesn't show up.
Sangeeta Rajan. And still to come in this podcast, renewed concerns for the German Chancellor Angela Merkel after she was spotted trembling and shaking for the third time in as many weeks. But first, a primary school playground in the Netherlands has been ordered to close because its children are too noisy. De Boot Primary School in Nijmegen has been given until the end of the month to ban pupils from the field or face a fine of approximately $11,000. Local residents complained that the children were exceeding a 70 decibel limit on residential areas.
Nicole Hesselink is the mother of three pupils at Debut Primary School. She's also a member of the Parents Association, as well as a local resident. She's been telling Ben James about when it all began.
So this all started to be a problem about 1.5 weeks ago. The school director sent an email to all the parents stating that the city council has told the school to remove the football field in the playground. So it's not the whole playground, it's the football field that we're talking about. And if it is not removed by the 22nd of July, then the school will have to pay a fine of 10,000 euros.
And this is because the sound from the football field has been judged to be too loud for the people living nearby.
Yes, it has. This football field is a 40-year-old field. And a few years ago, there have been construction. So there's a few buildings that have been built around the football field, very close to the field. So all the local residents by then already thought that's not a very good place to build new luxury apartment buildings. Now, some of the residents of these apartment buildings have a lot of problems with the noise that the children are making.
When you heard about the decision, what did you think? And indeed, what did your children think?
Well, the children of the school were all very angry and a little bit shocked, of course, because that's not a decision you expect a city council to make. So as the parents, we have decided not to wait and see what happens, but to take action in our own hands. So we have approached the media and local politicians, and we have tried everything that was in our power to get the city council to make another decision regarding the football field, since it is the only football field in the neighbourhood.
Do you feel for the people who live in those apartments at all? If
indeed
the sound is loud, it's been measured as being 88 decibels, which I looked it up. That's something along the lines of a food blender or maybe a truck going past, that kind of noise. Do you feel sorry for them that they are being disturbed?
Absolutely. So let it be clear that all the parents of the school children, we absolutely do feel for the people who are now complaining. I mean, they are somewhat elderly people. They want to have a quiet day. So we do understand their feelings and their problems with the situation. But we do think that there are a lot of possibilities that we can yet explore. I think there are a lot of techniques that we have not yet tried to minimize the noise. I must say that I'm very surprised by the amount of attention that this subject has drawn. But I do think that this problem will occur in a lot of places.
Nicole Hesselink speaking to Ben James. She's often called the most powerful woman in Europe, so it surprised and worried many to see the German Chancellor Angela Merkel trembling and shaking at a ceremony in Berlin on Wednesday afternoon. It's the third time in as many weeks that she's been seen struggling to control her hands and legs, but today she said she was very well and that there was no need to worry. Here's more from our Berlin correspondent, Damian McGuinness.
There's a lot of concern about this, partly because it's the third time it's happened, but also because it's so mysterious what's behind it. So far, the Chancellor and all government spokespeople have said that the Chancellor is doing well. She's not got any serious illness. They say that there's nothing to worry about and that she feels fine. But there's no information as to what the cause might be. And it's not even clear whether the Chancellor or the government representatives themselves know what the cause is. So that's adding to a lot of speculation about what might have happened. What one government representative has said of the second attack, was that this was almost psychological aftershocks of when it happened the first time. So you'll remember about 3 weeks ago, that was the first time this happened. It was during an official visit from the Ukrainian president to Berlin. And the shaking lasted a good few minutes. It was quite severe. It was very distressing to watch. And it was something that was not, created a lot of concern at the time. Interestingly, the second attack 9 days later looked similar, was also at a similar occasion as an official event with the president, the appointment of a minister. Then the shaking happened again. Representatives who were close to Mrs. Merkel said that this is it's almost an aftershock of what happened the first time because the situation was so similar.
Damian McGuinness. Let's go to Kenya now and the Kakuma refugee camp, which is the second largest in Africa. The UN says its economy is worth $56 million with a customer base of over 180,000 people. Anne Okumu went to meet those in the Turkana district camp who are turning from handouts to self-reliance.
At 3 in the afternoon, after several failed attempts, the generators come live in Kakuma's makeshift power station. It's a huge relief for the technician, Abdi, a refugee who fled Somalia in 2009. He's got dozens of clients asking to have their power lines connected.
We switch the generators on from 7 a.m. to noon, but then we have to switch them off until 3 p.m. so that they cool down.
With temperatures that can reach 40 degrees Celsius, it's hard to overestimate the importance of Abdi's work. He looks after two huge diesel-powered generators, which produce 90 kilowatts of power that light up 19 businesses and 180 homesteads. At the center of the room is a dusty switchboard with a web of wires peeling out of it. Lined up along the wall are dozens of jerrycans and three huge water tanks. Abdi uses the water to cool the generators down. Kakuma has a population of more than 180,000, but is yet to be connected to the national grid. Businesses and homesteads get their electricity from here, but only in low quantities and at specific times of the day. But Abdi says it's better than nothing.
Everyone benefits here. With electricity and you have a shop, you're able to sell cold soda and power your fridge. You can power your TV and also be able to charge phones.
Anwar is one Kakuma resident whose business largely depends on that electricity. He buys 40 kilograms of fish every week from Mombasa, more than 1,000 kilometers away to supply to his customers.
Fish is perishable and needs refrigeration. When the main supply fails, we use our small generators.
Kakuma refugee camp has been here for more than 25 years. Many people hope to be resettled in third countries, but others know they may spend the rest of their lives here. It's why building a business instead of relying on handouts can make such a difference. Ahmed Adan, in his 20s, sells affordable internet to the residents and has already connected over 600 devices.
We were using a data. All people, they are not getting a place to access Wi-Fi. And data, it was too much slow. But when you go in the cities, you see a Wi-Fi was running high speed. So I decided to look a solution. I enter college how to supply internet. When I learned how to supply internet, and then I come with my equipment, I came here.
Another problem for budding entrepreneurs here is that holding refugee status means they cannot integrate fully into society and access all services. The UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, says creative solutions are needed. Tayar Sukru heads the UN operation at Kakuma.
We need to create an environment. Refugees have access to different services by having the identity cards that allow them to move around. They will access the goods that is needed in Nairobi and elsewhere. They will establish the business links that it is and reach out to customers as they need to do.
Back in Kakuma's power hub, Abdi is monitoring the generators carefully for signs of overheating. Until 6 p.m., he knows his customers will be satisfied. After that, it's a long night before the power kicks in again.
That report from Anne Okumu in Kenya. It's been 18 months since the announcement that New Zealand's Prime Minister's cat had died. But now the truth about Paddle's death is out. It was the neighbour in the driveway with a car. Tom Singleton has the tale.
Paddle's was known as the first cat of New Zealand and had a Twitter account with thousands of followers. She came to public attention when she interrupted a phone call between her owner, the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, and President Trump. The magazine Vanity Fair said she'd helped establish Ms. Ardern as a cool, hip world leader. Few details of her death in November 2017 were made public. Now, Miss Ardern's rueful neighbour, identified only as Chris, has admitted running her down as he rushed to work. His children wrote a condolence card asking the Prime Minister not to send their father to prison. It seems they needn't worry. Today, the long-dormant First Cat Twitter account has posted, "I forgive you."
Tom Singleton. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.